Well, there's a simple explanation. And you, he continued, turning to me. A German paratrooper falls on your block, and you don't notify the authorities. You decide to enrich yourself at the city's expense. Is there a simple explanation for that, too? I needed water. My mouth was so dry it felt scaly, like the skin of a lizard, and I had begun to see bright little sparks of light swimming in the peripheries of my vision. Well? Sorry, I said. You're sorry. He looked at me a moment longer and laughed. Oh, well, you're sorry. All right, then. That's fine. As long as you're sorry, that's the important thing. Listen, boy, do you know how many people I've executed? I don't mean on my orders. I mean done it myself, with this Tokarev. Here he slapped the holstered pistol. Do you want to guess? No? Good. Because I don't know. I've lost count. And I'm the kind of man who likes to know. I keep track of things. I know exactly how many women I've fucked. And it's quite a few, believe me. You're a handsome boy, he said to Kolya. But trust me, you won't catch up with me, even if you live to 100. And that seems doubtful. I glanced at Kolya, expecting him to say something stupid and get us both killed. But Kolya, for once, had nothing to say. Sorry is what you say to the schoolmaster when you break a piece of chalk, the colonel continued. Sorry doesn't work for looters and deserters. We thought he might have a little food on him. The colonel stared at me for a long moment. Did he? Just some cognac, or brandy. A schnapps, maybe. We shoot a dozen people every day for forging ration cards. You know what they tell us before we put bullets in their brains? They were hungry. Of course they were hungry. Everyone is hungry. That won't stop us from shooting thieves. I wasn't stealing from Russians. You stole state property. Did you take anything from the body? I hesitated as long as I dared. A knife. Ah, the honest thief. I knelt, unstrapped the sheath from my ankle, and handed it to the colonel. He stared at the German leather. You had this on you all night? No one searched you? He exhaled with a soft curse, weary of the incompetence. No wonder we're losing the war. He pulled out the blade and studied the inscription. Blood and honor. Ha! May God fuck those whore sons in the ass. You know how to use it? What? The knife! Slashing, he said, slashing the air with the steel blade, is better than stabbing. Harder to block. Go for the throat, and if that's not working, go for the eyes or the belly. Thighs good, too. Big veins in the thighs. All this instruction was accompanied by vigorous demonstration. And never stop, he said, dancing closer, the steel flashing. Never let up. Keep the knife moving. Keep him on the defensive. He sheathed the blade and tossed it to me. Keep it. You'll need it. I stared at Kolya, who shrugged. All of this was too strange to understand, so there was no point straining the mind, trying to sort out where we stood. I got back on one knee and strapped the knife to my ankle again. The colonel had moved to the French windows where he watched yesterday's snow blowing across the frozen Neva. Your father was the poet. Yes, I admitted, standing straight and staring at the back of the colonel's head. No one outside my family had mentioned my father in 4 years. I mean this literally, not a word. He could write. What happened was unfortunate. What could I say to that? I stared at my boots and knew that Kolya was squinting at me, trying to figure out which unfortunate poet sired me. Neither of you has eaten today, said the colonel, not asking a question. Black tea and toast. How does that sound? Maybe we can find some fish soup somewhere. Borya! An aide stepped into the sunroom, a pencil tucked behind his ear. Get these boys some breakfast. Borya nodded and disappeared as quickly as he'd appeared. Fish soup. I hadn't had fish soup since summer. The idea of it was wild and exotic, like a naked girl on a Pacific island. Come over here, said the colonel. He opened one of the French doors and stepped into the cold. Kolya and I followed him along a gravel path that led through a frost-blasted garden down to the banks of the river. A girl in a fox fur coat skated on the Neva. In a normal winter, you'd see hundreds of girls skating on a weekend afternoon, but this wasn't a normal winter. The ice was solid, and had been for weeks, but who had the strength for figure eights? Standing on the frozen mud at the river's edge, Kolya and I stared at her, the way you'd stare at a monkey riding a unicycle down the street. She was freakishly lovely, her dark hair parted in the middle and tied up in a loose bun, her wind-whipped cheeks flushed and full and healthy. It took me a few seconds to realize why she looked so strange, and then it was obvious. Even at a distance, you could tell that the girl was well-fed. There was nothing pinched and desperate about her face. She had an athlete's casual grace. Her pirouettes were tight and fast, and never got winded. Her thighs must have been magnificent, long, pale, and strong, and I could feel my prick hardening for the first time in days. "She's getting married next Friday," said the colonel. "A piece of meat she's marrying, I say. But all right, he's a party man. He can afford her." "That's your daughter?" asked Kolya. The colonel grinned, his white teeth splitting his brawler's face. "You don't think she looks like me?" "No, no, she got lucky there. She's got her mother's face and her father's temper. This one will conquer the world." Only then did I realize that the colonel's teeth were false, a bridge that seemed to encompass the entire upper row. And I knew suddenly but surely that the man had been tortured. They had brought him in during one purge or another, called him a Trotskyite or a white or a fascist sympathizer, pried the teeth from his mouth, and beaten him till his eyes bled, till he pissed blood and shat blood, till the order came from whatever Moscow office. "We have rehabilitated the man. Let him alone now. He is one of us again." I could picture it because I had pictured it often. Whenever I wondered about my father's last days, he had the misfortune of being a Jew and a poet, and mildly famous, friends once with Mayakovsky and Mandelstam, bitter enemies with Abramovich, and others he considered tongues of the bureaucracy, the slingers of revolutionary verse who labeled my father an agitator and a parasite because he wrote about the Leningrad underworld, though officially there was no Leningrad underworld. More than this, he had the temerity to title his book Peter, the city's nickname, the name every native used but banned from all Soviet text because St. Petersburg was a czar's arrogance, named for the old tyrant's patron saint. One summer afternoon in 1937, they took my father from the offices of the literary magazine where he worked. They never gave him back. The call from the Moscow office never came for him. Rehabilitation was not an option. An intelligence officer might hold future value for the state, but a decadent poet did not. He might have died in the crosses, or in Siberia, or somewhere in between, we never learned. If he was buried, there is no marker. If he was burned, there is no urn. For a long time, I was angry with my father for writing such dangerous words. It seemed stupid that a book was more important than sticking around and slapping the back of my head when I picked my nose. But later I decided he hadn't chosen to insult the party, not consciously, not the way Mandelstam had. Mandelstam, with his crazy bravery, writing that Stalin had fat fingers like slugs, a mustache like two cockroaches. My father didn't know that Peter was dangerous until the official reviews were written. He thought he was writing a book 500 people would read, and maybe he was right, but at least one of those 500 denounced him, and that was that. The colonel has survived, though, and looking at him, I wondered if he found it strange that he had been so close to the shark's jaws and somehow fought his way back to shore, that he who had waited for another's mercy could now decide for himself whether to grant it. He didn't seem troubled at the moment. He watched his daughter skate. He clapped his busted knuckled hands as she spun. "So the wedding's this Friday. Even now, in the middle of all of this," said the colonel, gesturing with his hands to indicate Leningrad, the famine, the war. "She wants a real wedding. A proper wedding. This is good. Life must continue. We're fighting barbarians, but we must remain human. Russian. So we will have music, dancing, a cake. He looked at each of us in turn, as if there was something momentous about the word cake, and he needed us both to understand. "This is the tradition," says my wife. "We need a cake. It is terrible luck, a wedding with no cake." Now, I've been fighting all my life against these peasant superstitions. The priests use them to keep people stupid and afraid. But my wife, she wants the cake. Fine, fine, make the cake. For months she's been hoarding her sugar, her honey, flour, all the rest. I thought about this. The sacks of sugar, the jars of honey, the flour that must have been real flour, not moldy salvage from a torpedoed barge. Half the Kirov could probably survive 2 weeks on her batter alone. She has everything she needs, all except the eggs. Again the portentous look. "Eggs," said the colonel, "are hard to find." For several seconds we all stood silently, watching the colonel's daughter twirl. "The fleet might have some," said Kolya. "No, they don't. They have tinned beef. I traded a pack of playing cards for some tinned beef from one of the sailors. They don't have eggs." I don't think I'm stupid, but it was taking me a very long time to understand what the colonel was asking, and a longer time to fire up my courage to ask him.
"You want us to find eggs?"
"A dozen," he said. "She only needs 10, but I figure one might break, a couple might be rotten." He saw our confusion, and he smiled his wonderful smile, gripping our shoulders hard enough to make me stand straighter. "My men say there are no eggs in Leningrad, but I believe there is everything in Leningrad, even now, and I just need the right fellows to find it. A pair of thieves."
"We're not thieves,"
said Kolya, very righteous, staring into the colonel's eyes. I wanted to punch him. By all rights, we should have been dead and frozen, piled onto a sledge with the rest of the day's corpses. We had our reprieve. Our lives had been returned in exchange for a simple task, a strange task, perhaps, but simple enough. And now he was going to ruin it. He was asking for his bullet, which was bad, but he was asking for my bullet, too, which was far worse.
"You're not thieves.
You abandoned your unit." "No, no, shut up. Don't say anything." "You abandoned your unit, and the moment you did that, you forfeited your rights as a soldier in the Red Army. Your right to carry your rifle, to wear that coat, those boots. You're a thief. And you, Big Nose, you looted a corpse. It was a German corpse, so it doesn't personally offend me, but looting is theft. Let's not play games. You're both thieves. Bad thieves, that's true. Incompetent thieves, absolutely. But you're in luck. The good thieves haven't been caught." He turned and walked back toward the house. Kolya and I lingered, watching the colonel's daughter, her fox fur, flashing in the sun. She must have seen us by now, but she never acknowledged us, never glanced our way. We were two of her father's lackeys and therefore entirely boring. We watched her as long as we could, trying to etch the image into our brains for future masturbation, until the colonel barked at us and we hurried after him. "You have your ration cards?" he asked, taking long strides, his respite finished, ready again for the long day's work. "Hand them over." I kept mine pinned to the inside pocket of my coat. I unpinned it and saw Kolya pull his from his folded sock. The colonel took them from us. "You bring me the eggs by sunrise Thursday, you get them back. You don't. Well, you've got all of January to eat snow, and there won't be any cards waiting for you in February either. That's assuming one of my men doesn't find you and kill you before then, and my men are very good at that." "They just can't find eggs," said Kolya. The colonel smiled. "I like you, boy. You won't live a long life, but I like you." We stepped inside the sunroom. The colonel sat down at his desk and stared at the black telephone. He raised his eyebrows, remembering something, opened the desk drawer, and pulled out a folded letter. He held it out for Kolya. "That's a curfew waiver for the two of you. Anyone gives you trouble, show them that. You'll be on your way. And here, this too." He pulled 4 100-ruble notes from his wallet and gave them to Kolya. who glanced at the letter and the rubles and slipped them into his pocket. "That would have brought me 1,000 eggs in June," said the colonel. "And it will again next June," said Kolya. "Fritz won't last the winter." "With soldiers like you," said the colonel, "we'll be paying for eggs with Deutschmarks soon." Kolya opened his mouth to defend himself, but the colonel shook his head. "You understand this is a gift. You bring me 12 eggs by Thursday, I give you your lives back. You understand the rareness of this gift. What day is today?" "Today is Saturday. You deserted your unit on a Friday. When the sun rises tomorrow, it is Sunday. Can you keep track from this point forward?" "Yes?" "Good." Boria returned with 4 slices of toast on a blue plate. The toast had been slathered with something oily, lard maybe, glistening and fatty and luscious. Another aide stepped into the sunroom behind him, carrying 2 cups of steaming tea. I waited for a third aide, carrying bowls of fish soup, but he never came. "Eat quick, boys," said the colonel. "You've got a lot of walking to do." Chapter 4.
"Big Nose, I like that. Who was your father, Big Nose?"
"You wouldn't know him. If he was a published poet, I know him. Just leave it alone."
"You're a moody one, aren't you?"
We were crossing the Kamyano-Ostrovsky Bridge again, this time on foot. Kolya stopped at the midpoint, gloved hand on the balustrade, looking down the river toward the Dolgorukov mansion. The colonel's daughter no longer skated her figures, but Kolya watched for a moment anyway, hoping for an encore.
"She smiled at me," he said.
"She didn't smile at you. What are you talking about? She didn't even look at us."
"Perhaps you're jealous, my friend, but she definitely gave me a smile. I think I've seen her before, at the university. I have a reputation."
"As a deserter?" Kolya turned away from the balustrade and glared at me. "I'll knock your teeth out if you call me a deserter again. I'll shove my knife into your eye if you try it." Kolya considered this and turned back to his river view.
"I'd get to you before you could pull the knife. I'm very quick when I need to be."
I thought about pulling the knife now just to prove him wrong, but he didn't seem angry anymore and I wanted to keep moving. We crossed the bridge back to the mainland and headed south to Pesochnaya. The river to our right, the rusted rails of the Finland line to the left. No trains had run since September, when the Germans encircled the city and cut the tracks of every line. Finland, Moscow, Vitebsk, Warsaw, Baltic, all severed and useless. The city's only connection now with the rest of Russia was by air, and few planes could make it through the Luftwaffe patrols. We could run for it, of course. Tough without ration cards, though. He considered the problem. "The NKVD boys don't worry me much. In the army, they say the police can't find pussy in a whorehouse. But not having ration cards. Tricky." "We have to find the eggs," I told him. We were walking in the sunlight and breathing the air because of the colonel's command. If the payment for this reprieve was 12 eggs, we would find 12 fucking eggs. There was no room for negotiation or maneuvering. "Finding the eggs is the best outcome, I agree. Doesn't mean I can't consider my options. Maybe there are no eggs in the city. Then what? You still have family in Peter?"
"No. Me neither.
That's one good thing. Only have to worry about our own skins." Signs were posted on the walls of fire-gutted warehouses. "Have you signed up yet for the People's Volunteers?" There were no residential buildings in this area, and the street was empty, no one else walking beneath the colorless sky. We could have been the last 2 survivors of the war, the last 2 defenders of the city, with only my stolen knife and Kolya's purportedly quick fists to fight off the fascists. "The Haymarket's our best chance," said Kolya. "I was there a few months ago. They still had butter and cheese, a little caviar maybe."
"So how come the colonel's men couldn't find any eggs?"
"It's the black market. Half that stuff is stolen. You've got people trading their ration cards, all sorts of law-breaking. They're not going to sell to anyone in a uniform, especially not an NKVD uniform." It seemed like a reasonable argument. Collier whistled some tuneless song of his own invention, and we walked south toward the Haymarket. Things were looking up. Execution was not imminent. I had more food in my stomach than I'd had for weeks, and the strong black tea provided an extra spark. My legs felt strong enough to propel me wherever I needed to go. Someone somewhere had a dozen eggs, and we'd find them eventually. In the meantime, I enjoyed a vivid fantasy of the colonel's daughter skating naked on the Neva, her pale ass shining in the sun. Kolya slapped my back and gave me a lewd grin, as if he had stared right through my glass skull.
Remarkable girl, wasn't she? You'd like to take a shot at that.
I said nothing, but Kolya seemed long practiced at carrying on one-sided conversations.
The secret to winning a woman is calculated neglect.
What?
Ushakovo. It's a line from The Courtyard Hound. Oh, wait. You never read The Courtyard Hound, Kolya sighed, weary of my great ignorance. Your father was a member of the literati and he left you illiterate.
A little sad.
Why don't you shut up about my father?
Rachenka, the protagonist, is a great lover. People come from all over Moscow to get his advice on wooing. He never leaves his bed. He just lies there, drinking tea.
Like Oblomov?
Nothing like Oblomov. Why does everyone always say like Oblomov?
Because it sounds exactly like Oblomov. Kolya stopped walking and looked down at me. He was taller by a head and twice as broad in the shoulders, and he loomed over me now, threatening with his eyes.
Every university fool knows Goncharov wasn't half the writer Ushakova was. Oblomov is nothing. Oblomov is a morality lesson for the bourgeoisie. A little trifle you make your kids read so they don't grow up lazy. Now, Rachenko is one of the great heroes of the language. Him and Raskolnikov, and Boruskov, and I don't know, Chichikov maybe.
You're spitting on me.
Well, you deserve to be spat on.
I continued walking south, and Kolya, irritated as he was, soon fell into stride. Fate had shoved us together. That seemed beyond argument. Until Thursday, we were married. Across the snow-dusted ice of the Neva, the Golden Angel still sat atop the gilded spire of the Peter and Paul Cathedral, even though people said the Wehrmacht had promised an iron cross to the artillerymen who knocked it down. Kolya gestured toward the Petrograd side with his chin.
I was stationed at the fortress when the zoo was bombed. I heard there were baboons running around the city and a Siberian tiger.
That's a fairy tale, he said. None of them got out.
Maybe a few did. How do you know?
None of them got out. If you want to tell yourself something sweet to help you sleep, go ahead. But it's a lie. He spat on the ground. Fritz burned the whole place to the ground. Betty the elephant. I love that elephant. I'd go look at her all the time when I was a kid. The way she washed, sucking up water in her trunk and showering herself. She was graceful. You wouldn't think so. She was so damn big, but she was.
She died?
What did I just tell you? They all die.
Took Betty hours, though.
The way she moaned. I was on guard duty, and all I wanted to do was run over and shoot her in the heart. Just end it. You never want to hear an elephant dying. It was a long walk to the Haymarket. 6 kilometers, maybe. Over the Litchieni Bridge. Past the summer gardens where the elms and the oaks had been hacked down with hatchets. Past the church on spilled blood, with its glazed tile facade and soaring onion domes, built on the spot where Hinemyeshki splattered himself and the emperor. The farther south we walked, the more crowded the streets, everyone bundled in 3 layers, leaning into the wind as they walked, their faces pinched and wasted and pallid from lack of iron. On Yevsky Prospekt, all the shops had been closed for months. We saw 2 women in their 60s walking very close together, their shoulders touching, eyes on the sidewalk looking for the patch of ice that could kill them. A man with a glorious walrus mustache carried a white bucket filled with black nails. A boy, no more than 12,
tugged a sled with a length of rope. A small body wrapped in blankets lay on the sled, a bloodless bare foot dragging along the hard-packed snow. Dragon's teeth studded the street, reinforced concrete blocks arrayed in rows to hinder the movement of enemy tanks. A printed sign on the wall read, "Warning, this side of the street is the most dangerous during the bombing." Nevsky, before the war, was the heart of the city, built to rival the grand promenades of London and Paris, sidewalk kiosks hawking cherry blossoms and chocolates, the aproned old men behind the counter in Ilesiev's slicing smoked sturgeon and sable, the clock tower of City Hall rising above all the clamor, letting everyone know how late they were for whatever came next. Black Packards would whip past, horns blaring, carrying party members from one meeting to another. Even if you had no money to buy anything and nowhere important to go, Nevsky was always a good place to walk. In June, the sun didn't set till midnight, and nobody wanted to waste the light. You could watch the prettiest girls in Peter staring through the bright windows of the fancy shops, their eyes appraising the newest dresses for sale, studying the cut so they could make the dress at home if they managed to snatch enough material from work. Even if you never said anything to these girls, even if you always watched from a distance. "You're a virgin, aren't you?" said Kolya, interrupting my thoughts with such eerie timing it startled me. "Me?" I asked stupidly. "What are you talking about?" "I'm talking about the fact that you've never had sex. Sometime you know there's no point in lying. The game is over before it's begun."
"What do you care?"
"Listen, Lev, what if we try to be friends? What do you think about that? We're going to be together until we find these eggs. We might as well get along, right? Now, you seem like an interesting boy, a bit ornery, a bit moody in the Jewish way, but I like you. And if you weren't so fucking resistant all the time, I could probably teach you something."
"About girls?"
"About girls, yes. About literature. About chess."
"What are you, 19? How come you always talk like you're such an expert at everything?"
"I'm 20. And I'm not an expert at everything, just girls, literature, and chess. That's all." "And dancing. I'm an excellent dancer."
"What do you want to bet on a game of chess?"
Kolya glanced at me and smiled. He exhaled, his breath rising in vapor above his head. "I'll take that German knife of yours."
"And what do I get?"
"You won't get anything. You're not going to win.
But let's say I do.
I've got maybe another 100 grams of that sausage."
100 grams of sausage for a German pilot's knife? I don't think so."
"I have some pictures."
"What kind of pictures?"
"Pictures of girls, French girls. You'd learn things you'd need to learn." Pictures of French girls seemed like a prize worth playing for. I wasn't worried about losing the knife. There were plenty of people in Peter who could beat me at chess, but I knew all their names.
My father had been city champion when he was still in university. He used to take me with him on Thursdays and Sundays to the Spartak Chess Club at the Palace of the Pioneers. When I was 6, the club coach declared me a talent. For several years, I was one of the top-ranked young players, winning little ribbons and medals at tournaments throughout Leningrad Oblast. This made my father proud, though he was too much of a bohemian to admit to caring about competitions, and he never let me display my prizes in our apartment. When I was 14, I quit the club. I had learned that I was a good player, but would never be a great one. Friends of mine at Spartak, whom I had beaten consistently when we were younger, had left me far behind, advancing to a plane I could not access no matter how many games I played, how many books I read, how many endgame problems I worked on in bed at night. I was like a well-trained pianist who knows which notes to hit but can't make the music his own. A brilliant player understands the game in a way he can never quite articulate. He analyzes the board and knows how to improve his position before his brain can devise an explanation for the move. I didn't have the instincts. Quitting the club disappointed my father, but I wasn't sad about it. Chess became far more fun once I no longer had to worry about my citywide ranking.
Kolya stopped at the Kvisasanya Cafe and stared through a plate glass window covered with tape crosses. The restaurant inside was empty, all the tables removed, nothing but a linoleum floor and a chalkboard on the wall still marked with August's specials. I took a girl here once. Best lamb cutlets in the city. And then you took her home and made love to her, I said, deeply sarcastic, but immediately fearing that he had done exactly that. No, said Kolya, checking his reflection in the window and brushing some stray blonde hair back under his black fur cap. We made love before dinner. After dinner we had a drink at the Europa. She was mad for me, but I liked a friend of hers better. So why didn't you take the friend to dinner? Kolya smiled, a superior's kind smile for his simple subordinate. Calculated neglect. You need an education. We kept walking down Nevsky. It was 1 in the afternoon, but the winter sun was already drifting low in the western sky, our shadows elongating in front of us. So, let's start slow, he said. Let's start with basics. Is there a girl you like? No one special. Who said she needs to be special? You're a virgin. You need warm thighs and a heartbeat, not Tamara Karsavina. There's a girl named Vera who lives in my building, but she likes someone else. Fine. Step one. Let's not worry about someone else. Let's worry about Vera. What's special about her? Why do you like her? I don't know. She lives in my building. That's something. Anything else? She plays the cello. Beautiful instrument. What color eyes does she have? I don't know. You don't like the girl. You don't know what color eyes she has. You don't like her. I do like her, but all she cares about is Grisha Antokolsky, so what's the point? Fine, said Kolya, very patient with his dull charge. You think you like her because she doesn't like you. It's very understandable, but I'm telling you, you don't like her. Let's forget about Vera. Forgetting about Vera didn't seem hard to do. I had spent the last 3 years trying to imagine what she looked like naked, but only because she lived 2 floors below me. And once, at the youth center swimming pool, I had seen her nipples when her swimsuit strap slipped off. If it weren't for Vera's panic tumble by the Kirov's gate, I wouldn't have been wandering the streets of Peter with a lunatic deserter looking for eggs. She never looked back when the soldiers grabbed me. She was probably grubbing with Grisha in one of the Kirov's dark corridors while I was locked up in the crosses. The colonel's daughter was pretty. I like her. Kolya glanced at me, amused. Yes, the colonel's daughter is pretty. I like your optimism.
But that one's not for you.
She's not for you either. You might be wrong about that, if you saw the look she gave me. We walked past a group of young boys with stepladders and pails of whitewash who were busy painting over street signs and building numbers. Kolya stopped and stared at them. Hey! He shouted to the closest boy who wore so many layers of wool you would have thought he was fat unless you saw the drawn skin of his face, his eyes shining in black above shadows as deep as an old man's. Very few children this young were left in the city. Most had been evacuated back in September. The ones who remained tended to be very poor, many of them war orphans, with no family in the East. What the devil are you doing? Asked Kolya. He turned to me, stunned by this disrespect. Little bastards are vandalizing the prospect. Hey, boy! Suck my cock and make a wish, said the black-eyed boy, whiting out the number on the door of a watch repair shop. Even Kolya seemed taken aback by this directive. He walked over to the boy, took him by the shoulders, and turned him around.
You're talking to a soldier of the Red Army, boy.
Kolya, I started. You think this is the time for pranks, you and your little gypsy friends? You want to run around? You better take your hands off me, said the boy.
Now you're threatening me? I've been shooting at Germans the last 4 months, and now you want to threaten me?
Kolya, I repeated louder this time. They're on orders. If Fritz gets inside the city, he won't know where he's going. Kolya looked from the black-eyed boy to the whitewashed street signs and over to me.
How do you know that?
Because I was doing it 2 days ago. Kolya released the boy, who glared up at him a moment longer before resuming his work. Well, it's damn clever, said Kolya. And we kept on toward Haymarket. Chapter 5. If you had something you wanted to buy, sell, or barter, you went to the Haymarket. Before the war, the street stalls were considered the poor man's Nevsky Prospekt. After the blockade began, when the fancy shops closed one by one, when the restaurants chained shut their doors and the butchers had no more meat in their lockers, the Haymarket thrived. Generals' wives traded their amber necklaces for sacks of wheat flour. Party members haggled with peasants who had snuck in from the countryside, arguing over how many potatoes a set of antique silverware should purchase. If the negotiations lasted too long, the peasants would wave their hands dismissively and turn away from the city folk. So eat your silverware, they would say with a shrug. They almost always got their asking price. We walked from stall to stall, eyeing the stacks of leather boots, some still bloody from the feet of the previous owners. Tokarev rifles and pistols were cheap, easily bought with a few rubles or 200 grams of bread. Lugers and grenades were more expensive, but available if you asked the right person. One stall sold glasses of dirt for 100 rubles each. Badaev mud, they called it, taken from the ground under the bombed food warehouses and packed with melted sugar. Kolya stopped at a stall where a gaunt, stooped man with an eye patch and an unlit pipe in his mouth sold unlabeled bottles of clear liquor. "What's this?" asked Kolya. "Vodka."
"Vodka? Made from what?"
"Wood."
"That's not vodka, friend. That's wood alcohol.
You want it or not?"
"This isn't what we're here for," I told Kolya, who ignored me.
"Stuff makes a man blind," he said to the storekeeper. The one-eyed man shook his head, bored with the ignorance, but willing to exert some minimal effort to make a sale. "You pour it through linen," he said, "7 layers. After that, it's safe."
"Sounds like an elixir for the gods," said Kolya.
"You should call it 7-layer sin.
That's a good name for a drink."
"You want it?"
"I'll take a bottle if you drink some with me."
"It's too early for me," Kolya shrugged.
"I see you take a nip. I'll buy the bottle. Otherwise, what can I tell you? The war's made me a cynic."
200 rubles a bottle."
100. Let's drink."
"What are you doing?" I asked him, but he didn't even glance at me. The one-eyed man placed his cold pipe on the table, found a tea glass, and searched around his stall for a bit of cloth.
"Here," said Kolya, handing over a white handkerchief.
"It's clean. Relatively." We watched the man fold the handkerchief 3 times, drape it over the mouth of the tea glass. He poured the liquor slowly. Even outdoors, with the wind gusting, the stuff smelled like poison, like a cleaning agent used on a factory floor. The one-eyed man set aside the handkerchief, which was now flecked with soapy residue. He lifted the glass, sipped it, and set it back down on the table, his expression never changing. Kolya inspected the level of the liquid in the cup, making sure the vendor had truly taken a sip. Satisfied, he picked up the glass and saluted us.
"For Mother Russia!"
He downed the wood alcohol with a gulp, slammed the glass down on the table, wiped his mouth with the back of his hand, and gagged. He grabbed my shoulder, trying to support himself, his eyes wide open and tearing.
"You murdered me," he said, barely able to get the words out of his throat, pointing an accusing finger at the one-eyed man.
"I didn't tell you to drink it fast," he replied, unimpressed, putting the pipe back in his mouth. 100 rubles."
"Lev! Lev! Are you there?"
Kolya's face was turned toward mine, but his eyes were unfocused, looking straight through me. "Very funny." Kolya grinned and stood straight.
"Can't trick a Jew. I should have known." "Very good. Pay the man."
"What?" "Go ahead," he said, gesturing to the waiting vendor. "Give the man his money."
"I don't have any money."
"Don't try to cheat me, boy," roared Kolya, grabbing the collar of my greatcoat and shaking me till I felt my bones rattling. "I am a soldier of the Red Army, and I won't stand for any thievery." Abruptly, he released me, shoving his hands into my coat pocket, pulling out scraps of paper, a bit of string and lint, nothing close to money. Kolya sighed and turned to the vendor.
"Apparently we have no money. I'm afraid I'll have to cancel the transaction."
"You think because you're a soldier," said the one-eyed man, opening his coat to show us the hilt of a finished dagger, "I won't carve you up?"
I've got a glass of poison in my belly already, so why don't you try?
Kolya smiled at the man and waited for a response. There was nothing behind Kolya's blue eyes, neither fear nor anger nor excitement about the prospect of a fight. Nothing. This, I came to learn, was his gift. Danger made him calm. Around him, people would deal with their terror in the usual ways. Stoicism, hysteria, false joviality, or some combination of the three. But Kolya, I think, never completely believed in any of it. Everything about the war was ridiculous. The Germans' barbarity, the party's propaganda, the crossfire of incendiary bullets that lit the nighttime sky. It all seemed to him like someone else's story, an amazingly detailed story that he had stumbled into and now could not escape.
"Move on or I'll cut your lips off," said the one-eyed man, chewing the stem of his unlit pipe, hand on the hilt of his dagger.
Kolya saluted and marched off to the next stall, relaxed and unworried, as if the entire transaction had been clean and easy. I followed behind, heart thumping within my ribcage.
"Let's just find the eggs," I said. "Why do you have to go around provoking people?"
"I needed a sniff. I took a sniff. Now I feel alive again." He took a deep breath and exhaled through pursed lips, watching the condensation rise in the air. "We both should have died last night. Do you understand that? Do you understand how lucky we are? So enjoy it." I stopped at a stall where an old peasant woman wearing a headscarf sold patties of pale gray meat. Kolya and I stared at the meat. It looked fairly fresh, glistening with fat, but neither of us wanted to know what sort of animal it had been.
"Do you have any eggs?" I asked the old woman.
"Eggs?" she asked, leaning forward to hear.
"Not since September."
"We need a dozen," said Kolya. "We can pay good money."
"You can pay 1,000,000 rubles," she said. "There are no eggs, not in Peter."
"Where?"
She shrugged, the lines creasing her face so deep they seemed carved. "I have meat. You want meat? It's 300 for 2 patties, no eggs."
We went from stall to stall, asking everyone if they had eggs, but no one in the Haymarket had seen any since September. A few people had theories on where they could be found. High-ranking army officers had them flown in from Moscow. Farmers outside the city gave them to the Germans along with butter and fresh milk in exchange for their lives. An old man who lived near the Narva Gate kept chickens in a rooftop coop. This last rumor seemed obviously absurd, but the boy who told us insisted it was true. "You kill a chicken, maybe it will last you 1 week, but you keep it alive. Well, an egg a day along with your rations, that will get you by till summer."
"You have to feed a chicken," said Kolya. "Who's got food for a chicken?"
The boy, his black curly hair spilling out from beneath an old Imperial Navy cap, shook his head, as if it were a silly question.
"Chickens eat anything. A spoonful of sawdust, that's all they need."
The boy sold what people called library candy, made from tearing the covers off of books, peeling off the binding glue, boiling it down, and reforming it into bars you could wrap in paper. The stuff tasted like wax, but there was protein in the glue. Protein kept you alive, and the city's books were disappearing, like the pigeons.
"And you've seen these chickens?" asked Kolya.
"My brother has. The old man sleeps in the coop at night with a shotgun. Everyone in the building wants those chickens." Kolya glanced at me, and I shook my head. We all heard 10 different siege myths a day, stories of secret meat lockers stocked with chilled haunches of beef, of larders crammed with caviar tins and veal sausages. It was always someone's brother or cousin who had seen the treasure. People believed in the stories because it matched their conviction that someone, somewhere, was feasting while the rest of the city starved. And they were right, of course. The colonel's daughter might not be eating roasted goose for dinner, but she was eating dinner.
"The old man can't stay in the coop all the time," I told the boy. "He has to get his rations. He has to get water and use the toilet. Someone would have grabbed the chickens months ago."
"He pisses off the roof. When it's coming out the other side, I don't know. Maybe that's what he feeds the chickens." Kolya nodded, impressed by the old man's clever means of keeping the birds alive, though I was convinced the kid was making this up as his lips moved.
"When was the last time you had a shit?" Kolya asked me abruptly.
"I don't know, 1 week ago.
It's been 9 days for me. I've been counting. 9 days. When it finally happens, I'll have a big party and invite the best-looking girls from the university.
Invite the colonel's daughter.
I will. Absolutely. My shit party will be much better than this wedding she's planning.
The new ration bread hurts coming out, said the curly-haired boy. My father says it's all the cellulose they're putting in.
Where do you find the old man with the chickens?
I don't know the address. If you walk towards Stachek Prospekt from the Narva Gate, you'll pass his building. There's a big poster of Zhdanov on the wall. There's a poster of Zhdanov on half the buildings in Peter, I said, getting a little irritated. We're going to walk another 3 kilometers to find a bunch of chickens that don't exist? The boy's not lying, said Kolya, patting the kid on his shoulder. If he is, we'll come back here and break his fingers. He knows we're NKVD.
You're not NKVD, said the boy.
Kolya pulled the colonel's letter from his coat pocket and slapped the boy's cheek with it. This is a letter from an NKVD colonel authorizing us to find eggs. What do you think about that? You got another one from Stalin authorizing you to wipe your ass? He'll have to authorize me to shit first. I didn't stay long enough to learn how the conversation ended. If Kolya wanted to tramp all over the city looking for the fabled chickens, that was his business. But nightfall was coming, and I wanted to go home. I hadn't slept in 30-some hours. I turned and walked toward the Kirov, trying to remember how much bread I had stashed under the loose tile in the kitchen. Maybe Vera had something for me. She owed me, after the way she ran, never looking back even though I'd rescued her. It occurred to me that Vera and the others must have thought I was dead. I wondered how she had reacted, whether she had cried, hiding her face in Grisha's chest as he comforted her, or maybe pushing him away, angry because Grisha had fled, abandoned her, while I stayed behind and saved her from certain execution. And Grisha would say, I know, I am a coward, forgive me. And she would forgive him, because Vera forgave Grisha everything, and he would wipe away her tears and tell her they would never forget me, my sacrifice. But of course they would. Within a year they wouldn't be able to picture my face anymore. You there! You the one looking for eggs? Obsessed with my pitiful fantasy, it took me a moment to realize the question was meant for me. I turned and saw a bearded giant staring back at me, arms folded across his chest, rocking back and forth on his boot heels. He was the biggest man I'd ever seen, far taller than Kolya, and broader in the chest. His bare hands looked big enough to crack my skull like a walnut shell. His beard was thick and black, and shined as if oiled. I wondered how much food a man that big needed to eat every day, how he could possibly keep the meat on his titanic frame. "You have eggs?" I asked, blinking up at him. "What do you have for me?"
"Money. We have money. Wait, let me get my friend."
I ran back through the Haymarket. For the first time since I'd met him, I was happy to see Kolya's blonde head. He was still joking with the curly-haired boy, probably describing his dream of a glorious shit.
"Hello, there he is," he shouted when he saw me. "I thought you'd run off without me. There's a man who says he has eggs." "Excellent,"
Kolya turned to the boy.
"Son, it has been a great pleasure."
We walked back the way I'd come, passing the stalls, now shutting for the night. Kolya handed me a wrapped library candy.
"Here you are, my friend. Tonight we feast."
"The kid gave it to you?"
"Gave it to me. He sold it to me."
"How much?" 100 for 2.
100?
I glared up at Kolya as he unwrapped his bar and took a bite, grimacing at the flavor. "So we have 300 left?"
"Correct. Impressive arithmetic. That money is for the eggs. Well, we can't go egg hunting without a little something to keep us going."
The bearded man waited for us at the edge of the Haymarket, arms still folded. He appraised Kolya as we came nearer, sizing him up the way a boxer takes the measure of his opponent. "It's just the two of you?"
"How many of us do you need?"
asked Kolya in return, smiling at the giant.
"I hear you sell eggs."
"I sell everything. What do you have for me?"
"We have money," I said,
fairly sure we had already gone over this.
"How much?"
"Enough," said Kolya.
"We need 12 eggs."
The bearded man whistled.
"You're in luck. That's all I have."
"You see that?" said Kolya, gripping my shoulder. "This wasn't so hard." Follow me, said the giant, crossing the street.
Where are we going?
I asked as we followed. I keep everything inside. It isn't safe out here. Soldiers come down every few days, steal everything they want. Anyone says anything, they shoot him.
Well, the soldiers are out there defending the city, said Kolya. They can't fight if they're starving.
The giant glanced at Kolya's army coat, his regulation boots.
Why aren't you defending the city?
I'm on a mission for a certain colonel. Nothing you need to worry about.
This colonel sent you and the boy on a mission for some eggs, is that it?
The giant grinned down at us. His teeth gleamed like unmarked dice within his black beard. He didn't believe Kolya, of course. Who would?
We walked alongside the frozen Fontanka Canal, the ice littered with abandoned corpses, some covered with shrouds, weighted down with stones, others stripped for their warm clothes, their white faces staring up at the darkening sky. The wind was beginning to wake for the night, and I watched the dead woman's long blonde hair blow across her face. She had taken pride in that hair once, washed it twice a week, brushed it out for 20 minutes before going to bed. Now it was trying to protect her, to shield her decay from the eyes of strangers. The giant led us to a 5-story brick building, all the windows boarded over with plywood. A massive poster, 2 stories high, portrayed a young mother carrying her dead child from a burning building. "Death to the baby killers," read the text. After fishing in his coat pocket for his keys, the giant unlocked the front door and held it open for us. I grabbed Kolya's sleeve before he could enter.
"Why don't you bring the eggs down here?" I asked the giant.
"I'm still alive because I know how to run my business, and I don't do business on the street." I could feel my scrotum tightening, my timid balls creeping closer to my body. But I was born and raised in Peter. I wasn't a fool, and I tried to keep my voice steady as I spoke. "I don't do business in strangers' apartments."
"Gentlemen, gentlemen," said Kolya, smiling broadly. "No need for all the suspicion. 12 eggs, name your price."
1,000.
1,000 rubles for 12 eggs?
I laughed.
"Are they Fabergé?"
The black-bearded giant, still holding the door open, glowered down at me. I stopped laughing. "They're selling glasses of dirt back there for 100 rubles, he told me. "Which is better, an egg or a glass of dirt?"
"Listen," said Kolya.
"You can stand here all day haggling with my little Jewish friend, or we can talk like honest men. We have 300. That's all we have. Is it a deal?"
The giant continued to stare at me. He hadn't liked me from the start. Now that he knew I was a Jew, I could tell he wanted to peel the skin from my face. He held out his massive palm to Kolya, beckoning for the cash.
No, at this point I must side with my companion," Kolya said, shaking his head.
"First the eggs, then the money."
"I'm not bringing them out here. Everyone's starving and everyone's got a gun."
"You're an awfully big man to be so afraid," teased Kolya.
The giant eyed Kolya with something like curiosity, as if he couldn't quite believe he was hearing the insult. Finally he smiled, flashing those dice-white teeth.
"There's a man face down out there," he said, gesturing with his chin to the Fontanka Canal. "Wasn't hunger that got him. Wasn't the cold. His skull got smashed in with a brick. You want to ask me how I know?"
"I take your point," said Kolya, quite agreeable. He peered into the darkness of the building's vestibule.
"Well, for what it's worth, a brick is quicker."
Kolya patted me on the back and stepped inside. Everything I knew told me to run. This man was leading us into a trap. He had practically just confessed to being a murderer. Kolya had stupidly admitted exactly how much money we had on us.
It wasn't much, but 300 rubles and 2 ration cards, which the giant must have assumed we still had, were easily enough to get killed over these days.
But what was the other choice? Head down to the Narva Gate and find some fabled old man and his chicken coop? We were risking our lives walking into the building, but if we didn't find the egg soon, we were dead anyway. I followed Kolya. The front door closed behind us. It was gloomy inside, with no electricity for the bulbs, and only the last of the daylight peeking in through gaps in the plywood covering the windows. I heard the giant moving behind me, and I dropped to one knee, ready to unsheath my knife.
He passed by me and climbed the stairs, two at a time. Coley and I glanced at each other. When Blackbeard was out of sight, I pulled out the German knife and slipped it into my coat pocket. Kolya raised his eyebrows, possibly impressed by the act, possibly mocking me. We headed up the stairs, taking them one by one, but still panting by the time we reached the second floor.
"Where do you get the eggs?"
asked Kolya, calling out to the giant who was already a flight above us. The big man was untroubled by the climb. He and the colonel's daughter were the two fittest people I'd seen in Peter in months. I wondered again where he got his energy. "There's a peasant I know. He works on a farm near Magah." "I thought the Germans took Magah." "They did. The Germans like their eggs, too. They come every day and grab all they can find. But my friend hides a few. Can't hide too many, or they'll figure it out." The giant stopped on the fourth floor and rapped on an apartment door. "Who is it?"
"It's me," he said, "with a couple of customers."
We heard a deadbolt slide back and the door opened. A woman wearing a man's fur hat and a bloodied butcher's apron blinked at Kolya and me, wiping her nose with the back of her gloved hand.
"What I was wondering," said Kolya, "is how you keep the eggs from freezing, because frozen eggs won't do us much good, I'm afraid."
The woman stared at Kolya as if he were speaking Japanese. "We keep them by the samovar," said the giant. "Come on, let's get it over with." He gestured for us to enter the apartment. The silent woman stepped to the side to let us pass, and Kolya walked right in, not a care in the world, looking around with a smile as if he'd just been invited into a new girlfriend's place. I waited by the door until the giant put his hand on my shoulder. He didn't shove me exactly, but with a hand that big, the effect was the same. Wick lamps lit the small apartment, and our long shadows crept across the walls, across the frayed rugs on the floor, the brass samovar in the corner, and a white sheet hanging on the far side of the room, partitioning off a sleeping area, I assumed. When the giant closed the door, the sheet billowed like a woman's dress in the wind. In the moment before it settled down, I saw what lay behind it. Not a bed, no furniture at all, just slabs of white meat hanging from hooks, suspended from a heating pipe by heavy chains, with plastic sheeting on the floor to collect the drippings. Maybe for half a second, I thought it was a pig. Maybe my brain tried to convince my eyes that they weren't looking at what they were looking at. A flayed thigh that could only be a woman's thigh. A child's rib cage. A severed arm, with the hand's ring finger missing. The knife was in my hand before I realized I wanted it. Something moved behind me and I wheeled and slashed, crying out, unable to form any words, throat constricted. The giant had pulled a foot-long section of steel pipe from his coat. He danced away from me, far quicker than a man that big should be, easily dodging the German steel. The giant's wife drew a cleaver from her apron pouch. She was quick, too, but Kolya turned out to be the quickest of all, pivoting on his back foot and hitting the woman with a right cross to the jaw. She crumpled to the floor.
"Run," said Kolya.
I ran. I thought the door would be locked, but it wasn't. I thought the giant's pipe would crush my skull, but it didn't, and I was out in the hallway, hurtling down the staircase, jumping nearly the entire flight to the landing below. I heard a great shout of pure, unworded fury and the thud of the giant's hobnailed boots on the floorboards as he charged across the room. I stopped there with my hand on the banister, unable to catch my breath, unwilling to run farther away, unable to climb the dark stairs back to the cannibal's apartment. I heard the terrible sound of steel slamming into skull or plywood. I was betraying Kolya, deserting him when he was weaponless and I had a good knife. I tried to will my feet to move, to carry me back to the battle, but I was shaking so hard I couldn't keep my knife hand steady. More shouts, more thuds of pipe on what? Plaster flakes fell from the ceiling above me. I cowered on the stairs, certain that Kolya was gone, certain I could not run fast enough to escape the giant. His wife would carve me with a few expert chops of that heavy cleaver, and soon the parts of me would be hanging from steel chains as the last of my blood dripped onto the plastic sheeting. The shouting continued. The walls shuddered. Kolya was not dead yet. I held the knife with both hands and put one foot on the step above me. I could sneak into the apartment while the cannibal was distracted, stick the knife in his back, but the blade seemed flimsy to me now, far too small for killing giants. It would prick him, draw a